Welcome to the Girl Dad Show, a professional parenting podcast. Each month, I interview entrepreneurs, leaders, and professionals who are balancing parenthood, life, and profession in the hopes to learn what it takes to be an amazing professional parent. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Girl Dad Show. Today, I had Brian Franklin on the show, a executive coach. I like to call him a performance coach. I mean, this guy is just an incredible, incredible coach. Even during the podcast, I was getting so much insight and philosophy from him, and you could tell why he's so successful at doing it. We unpack the evolution of parenting and his thesis on what a good parent should be and what that looks like, you know, looking at the micro and macro of historical context, and just overall had a really great conversation about his childhood and his business and how he is raising his son. I am so excited for you guys to check out this episode. It's a really, really great one. And this guy is just super smart and super fun and very, very interesting. So I hope you enjoy the show. Brian, thank you so much for joining me on my show today.
It's my absolute pleasure. When you asked me to come on the show and we were already jamming on these topics, it just felt like the natural thing.
Totally, right? I loved our first conversation. I've been thinking about our conversation. I've been so inspired ever since, and I can't wait to talk to you for the second time, but on the show. It's going to be so great. So let's dig right into it. Why don't you tell the listeners what you do for a living?
Yeah, so I'm an executive coach, and I've been coaching CEOs and founders in Silicon Valley for over 20 years, 22 years now, which that's getting to be a long time. I always used to be younger than my clients. Now I'm older than my clients. So I'm through that transition. In that time, I've helped 9 companies scale from startup to over $1 billion in revenue. I was Reid Hoffman's coach at LinkedIn for 5 years leading up to their IPO. So I've seen a lot of rapid scale. Written a book called The Last Safe Investment about how to invest in yourself. And I just am here to maximize everybody else's experience and access to what they want.
That's amazing. I love that story and trajectory, but I didn't know that you were usually younger than your clients.
Yeah, well, I was 27 when I started coaching.
What?
I would walk in and I would be introduced to a 55-year-old CEO of a startup. And they, you know, and this kid would walk in. And by the way, I was 27. Looks wise, I was like going on 13.
I know what you mean. Okay, you're painting the picture.
I was not a mature looking 27. Some would say not mature in many ways. So I figured I had like 30 seconds to not have the CEO say, "Get this kid out of my office."
Yeah.
I used to open the relationship with the sort of going to the hardest thing to say or hear. That was true. And starting with that, so like I'd be introduced and say, "Hey, nice to meet you. So I understand the board is looking to hire your replacement. I'm wondering if you know why that might be." That would be first, so that we could get past the idea of what's this kid doing in my office and onto something else. But I don't have to do that anymore. Now I can be like a little more, you know, gentle with the introduction, and I'll just find out what's going on and see how I can help.
And do you think that has a lot to do with the age, or you think that's part of the age and part of experience? And because you've done a lot more than executive coaching, right? I mean, we only dabbled a little bit into it the last 15 minutes of our last conversation, but you think it's a little bit of both?
I think it's both. Yeah. When I was younger, I felt like I had something to prove, but it wasn't wrong. I did have some, you know, but yeah. I also felt like it. So I was coming in with that having to prove something energy, and I don't have something to prove anymore on that, you know, on that front. So
when did that happen for you? Was it after kids or was it a certain age?
It was not. The kids didn't do all of it. There was still some left. It was actually, so I've been married twice. I just celebrated my 10-year anniversary of my,
congratulations.
Thank you, for my second marriage. And when my first marriage fell apart, I realized that most of what I thought about how life was wasn't accurate. I kind of thought I was winning, and then I had to come face to face with the fact that I was losing, and I had been doing a lot of pretending that things were okay when they weren't okay.
Are you talking about professionally or personally or both?
Well, as a coach, it's hard to separate those. So
whoa.
Personally, for sure, but my job as a coach is to understand you, what you want, what you're trying to accomplish, and why you might not be accomplishing it. You know, what's in your way that you don't see from the from making your dreams come true. And there's no way that that like falls into this neat little bucket called professional, right? It's everything about your conclusions about reality itself, who you are, why you're here, what you're doing, why people do the things that they do, how people react to you, the unconscious ways that you influence people to either be your ally or to be an obstacle. Like, what's going on with you? What's your entire experience and what generates that? All of that is my professional sort of theater. So when I have a personal revelation, it immediately impacts my professional work. And if I realize, oh, I had felt insecure in my relationship or in some personal domain, then I start to see, once I realize I don't have to have that insecurity anymore, I can now see that insecurity for what it is in other people, even when it's expressed through their professional decisions.
Oh,
so
got it.
It's sort of that, that's how it all kind of flows from one to the other, if that makes sense.
It's very pervasive, it sounds like. You're able to like kind of like live it almost porously, like taking insights from this side to this side, this side to that side, and kind of wash it back and forth and stitch the parallels together.
I want to hop skip
and jump and then come back to this, but so when did you have kids between this journey? So 27-year-old coach, and then when did the kids come in?
So it's kids singular. My son's name is Spencer. I hope I'm still qualified for the Girl Dad Show, even though I'm a boy.
Absolutely.
I'm a boy dad.
Yes.
I'm sure you get that before, but Spencer, who definitely identifies as boy and uses the he, him pronouns, he's 17. So it was, what, 2004, and I was 33. So your quick at math listeners can figure out my age and stuff like that. But and that was my first wife. So my first wife is his mom. And he was about 4 when we got divorced, which was, as you could guess, the hardest part of that experience was feeling like I was letting him down, basically. He's amazing. I absolutely adore our relationship, and he's just an incredible, incredible young man.
Yeah, that's awesome. And then did he understand, at 4 years old, you probably had some inkling of what you did for a living, right, at that point?
Oh, yes. In fact, from time to time, I'd be called to speak on stage and teach entrepreneurs or give a motivational speech or that kind of thing. And I was at a conference with 300 or 400 entrepreneurs in the audience, and I was giving some lecture on some entrepreneurial concept. And he said that he wanted to speak at the conference. And so I said,
oh, wow.
So I said, he was like maybe five.
Wow.
And I said, okay, that sounds great. So I gave him the microphone. And he said, I have two stories to tell you about risk. He's telling, you know, to the entrepreneurs, because he had the idea, I guess, maybe he'd heard me say it or whatever, that entrepreneurs and risk go together. So he said, I have two stories that I want to tell you about risk. And he said, the first is that I had a dream and I was being chased by a many-eyed monster on a bicycle. And no matter how fast I ran, I couldn't get away. I was so afraid. And the second story is that I was super afraid on my very first day of kindergarten that I would get to school and that no kids would like me. It's the first time I'd ever heard him say that. I had no idea that he had that fear.
Yeah.
And he said, and what I want you to know is that what both of these stories have in common is that they aren't real. It's that fear is made up. Because when I got to kindergarten, it was fine. And when I woke up from the dream, it's fine. So if you're feeling fear, it's not real. That was his message.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's Spencer. So not only does he have an idea, or did have an idea of what I was doing, but I think he kind of started to get the idea of how to do it himself. Yeah.
Osmosis.
Yeah.
Just by like total nurture and a little nature, it sounds like.
I don't know where it came from. It feels to me, my experience is that it comes from him, not from, like it comes from him to me, not from me to him. I experience him just emerging with never having lost his connection to wisdom.
It's amazing. And it's very, very insightful for such a young age. I have to ask, what is he doing now?
So he is actually doing an internship at a company that's developing the very first carbon negative jet fuel. And he's researching the different prices and uses and sources of jet fuel in all sorts of different industries. So he's doing a research project as an internship for the company's called 12, this company that's developing this technology. He's very, very into science.
Wild.
You know, he's very focused on math and science. He'll undoubtedly be studying something like that in physics. I think he said theoretical physics is what he wants to study.
Wow. And did he always show an inkling into that? Did he ever show any kind of like inkling for coaching or speaking?
He definitely felt like a natural coach speaker type person to me. But his interests, you know, the more he was keying off of his own interest and not just emulating dad, the more science and math emerged. He always was very curious about how things worked. His attention span for you describing how like ABS brakes work or how the difference between an analog radio and a digital radio. He would listen to you talk for hours, and every time he heard a word that he didn't know what it meant, he'd stop you and ask you what's that word. And then, you know, just keep just this whole window into understanding of how things work. So I think that has manifested in his interest in math and science.
And then how do you feel about him taking this career and kind of going down this technical route, functionally very deep and specific route?
Well, you've just hit on a question which gets to the heart of, I think, what might be different about me than a lot of other parents.
Yeah.
Which is that I've detached my sense of worth or identity from anything that occurs for him.
Huh.
So I don't the only feelings I have about his choices are whether or not they are likely to turn into what he hoped they would. In other words, if he makes a choice which I think isn't going to turn out the way he thinks, I have a concern and I'll share that concern with him. But if he makes a choice that does turn out the way that he thinks it will, then I'm happy, regardless of whether that would have been my choice. Yeah, I mean, I have many examples of this, but
So, I mean, I'd love an example for sure. But just to get my mind wrapped in the right direction of what you're saying, are you saying like you're more interested in him figuring out what he thinks is successful for him and then what that delta looks like? And then basically just being, for lack of better words, a coach.
Kind of.
And helping him find his path. Essentially,
even that is a little more heavy-handed, helping him find his path. I don't think he needs help finding it.
Got it. So it's even less than that.
Yeah. If that's only if finding his path is something he's interested in. If he is not interested in finding his path, then that's okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's very, very different. It's very different than me, that's for sure. I have very, very clear, specific things that I want my kids to do and achieve. So that's amazing. Yeah. Why'd you come to this conclusion and this philosophy? I mean, it's very, very unique and it's very cool. And I definitely want to unpack that.
Well, when you asked me to come on the podcast, I'm like, oh, I've got some juicy stuff to talk about. I know this is, different than a lot of people do it, but, well, I think humanity in general is evolving. I think that, like, if you zoom out to, thousands of generations, we're generally evolving as a species into something better than we used to be. And if we continue to do that, I think we're going to turn into something better than we are now. More loving, more whole, more happy, more self-empowered, more self-generative, more harmonious with each other. I just believe that generally speaking, we're on that kind of trajectory. And I think the main way that we're evolving in the short term is in our belief systems. So I think each generation has an improvement to their belief systems from the previous generation. And we don't even have to look that far in our rearview mirror to see a generation that believed that showing love to a child would spoil them, and that, you know, like, that physically harming them was a good way to teach them a lesson. So I think our current ethos, belief systems, are an improvement over that. I think the improvement's going to keep going, and it's kind of like evolution's kind of like a relay race to the moon for ants. Each little ant has their little distance that they can grow and better themselves, and then they pass the baton. So if you were to expand or grow or evolve your belief system beyond the capacity of mine, I would cease to be able to understand your choices. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
If you have a more evolved belief system than mine, I am not going to be able to model, predict, or anticipate your decisions, because they won't make sense in my more compressed, less...
structured.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Make sense? Just like a low... If you have a low-res picture, you can't describe a detail that you can only see in the high-res picture.
Totally.
And so... unless you opt out of evolution, you have to get to a point where your parents don't understand you. And I'm not sure as a parent when that starts, but I'm ready for it to start at any moment. So if I'm asserting my assessment of what Spencer should and shouldn't do, should or shouldn't like, should or shouldn't want, should or shouldn't accept, I'm actually tugging him backwards on the evolutionary scale towards me, saying, I want you to succeed within my framework, instead of allowing him to evolve his own framework.
That's amazing. I love that you like went almost like historical macro, then you went macro present, and then like then you went deeper in, and then you started realizing how that applies to you, and then you're part in something that you might not even understand.
Yeah, if I really believe in evolution, how can I tell him that he should do this and not do that? You know, there are, it's not that long ago that people would say you shouldn't have a mixed race marriage, that you shouldn't marry outside your religion. You know, that, you know, these kinds of very limiting views that were based in fear.
Yeah.
How do I know which of my views are limiting based on fear? They didn't know which ones they're... You know what I mean? To the person with the limiting view, you can't tell the difference.
Yeah, and do you think your mind thinks like this because you're constantly talking to entrepreneurs that are pushing the envelope and like always kind of like breaking frontiers? Do you think that that's where your philosophy and kind of, this is very philosophical, you know what I mean? And like the concept.
I am a very philosophical guy, yeah.
But do you think that has a lot to do with the fact that you're just constantly surrounded by, you know, frontier people, you know?
Well, it's definitely self-fulfilling, because it's either that or I got into the business because this is how I think. I don't really know which. Absolutely, it could be that. Yeah. I'm certainly reinforced. You know, if you're an accountant, you want to really make sure that you don't make a lot of math errors.
Yeah.
Right? So maybe you're getting better and better and better at being detail-oriented throughout your whole career, so you can handle more and more complex situations without making making any errors. Well, in my business, I need to have a more and more clear understanding of who we are and what we're doing here in order to do my work. And I think I chose the work because I like that pursuit. It's pleasurable for me. But that doesn't mean it has to be pleasurable for Spencer. You know, the more he got into science, the less he was interested in, you know, metaphysical or psychological things. And it's just not where his interest lies. His interest lies in understanding, you know, the physics answer to why we are here, not the spiritual answer.
And then what about his mom and his stepmom? What do they think about this kind of philosophy and concept?
So stepmom and I are totally aligned in lockstep. We kind of co-developed the household philosophy that as long as he's safe When he was very little, I only had a couple rules. You can't kill yourself, harm other people, or damage other people's property without their permission. That's kind of it. If it's not that, it's not a rule.
That's crazy. I love it. Okay. That's awesome. Yeah. So simple.
And when you're like five, I'm going to pretty much use my judgment on those things. But when you're 15, it's going to be definitely more of a collaboration. Right. And his biological mom is by nature a lot more, interested in having his choices line up with her, like, likes and dislikes. However, she's also very keyed into whether he seems happy and relaxed.
Oh,
and
good.
So if something's making him happy and relaxed, and she's uncomfortable with it, she will work on getting more comfortable with it because she'll view that as her work. And in that way, we're aligned.
That's amazing. So he has the whole ecosystem as well, kind of like supporting this kind of environment. Totally. Does he realize that this is a conscious decision that you've made? Does he realize that, or is...
Yeah, we definitely talked
okay,
about it.
Okay, does he reference his friends and kind of know the anomalous nature of this situation?
I mean, I always get a very detailed gratitude note on Father's Day about the kind of father that I am and why that matters to him. And I remember one where he said, most of all, he would really appreciate that I let him make mistakes so he can learn the consequences.
Hmm.
And he feels like he's learned more from making his own mistakes than he could ever learn from being told what to do. And so I think he knows. I think he knows it's unusual.
Yeah. It's amazing. And so as you think about Spencer, you know, and I'm like... kind of earlier on in my dad career here and my professional career, actually. So a little bit of both. So I'm kind of asking more for a kind of like feedback and advice here. But would you say that that's like the barometer of success that you've created as it relates to being a dad and as a parent?
Close. So when his mom was pregnant with him, she and I sat down and we said, okay, how are we going to parent? How are we going to evaluate ourselves as parents? Let's get on the same page. And and we decided that there were three beliefs that we wanted Spencer to have. And we were going to judge our parenting based on those beliefs and only those. The first is we wanted him to believe that he makes good decisions.
Mm-hmm.
The second is that we wanted him to believe that people he doesn't know can't wait to love him. They just have to meet him, and then they'll find out. So if he doesn't know the person, they're a new friend waiting to happen, basically.
Hmm.
And then the third is there are some things you can do, and there's some things you cannot do. But in the middle, that gray area where you're not sure you can. You always can. You just have to learn what's the proper sequence. So there's can and can't, and then that gray area is always a can. If you're not sure, you can. And those are the three beliefs. So that's how you asked, like, how do we measure our success? That's how we measured our success. And like when he was, before he could talk, whatever, he'd bump his head or something, and we'd say, oh, well, that's what happens when you do that, you know. We wouldn't rush to try and save him from the experience. It was like, well, that's that decision. You know, that's how that turns out. And it was quite natural and organic for us, actually. So he's dyslexic, like his father. And he was starting to struggle in school because reading was very challenging. And And so he started to struggle in reading, and then he started to struggle in other aspects of school. And then the teachers at the school, this is like first grade, started to relate to him as a struggling student. And then the peers started to relate to him as a struggling student. And then he started to relate to himself as someone who couldn't do things. So we saw this happen over a few months. And so we had a lot of conversations together about him, about it. And I said, you know, that there are other schools that are not this school that specialize in teaching different ways that might be more compatible with someone who's dyslexia like I do and like you do. And if you want to see one of those other schools, we can go. And if you want to go to one of those other schools, you can choose whether you want to go to second grade or do first grade again. And here are some of the things that might, just so while you're making the choice, like you might be a different age than the other kids if you do first grade again. You might be older than everybody. So you might not fit in that same way. When people talk about how old they are, you're going to have to say that you're a different age than they are. And if you keep on going and you're still struggling with the, with the reading, you might find that things are easier for the other kids for a while and harder for you. The same thing is going to be harder for you to do than them. So we talked about it. We went and visited a classroom, and he decided he wanted to go to the different school and he wanted to repeat first grade. And so that's what he did. And so that's a manifestation of, we want him to know that he makes good decisions. And so part of that is really trusting that he knows what's best.
Does he remember that?
Yeah.
I was going to say, like, that's really interesting, because if you have these kind of conversations from the get-go and you, like, are talking to him at such an early age, he's growing up with that kind of notion and environment understanding, and you're, like, expecting him to understand it, you know? And so I look at my kid right now, who's, like, 5, and I'm like, yeah, I think she's, like, the cusp. Like, she might have some understanding of that, right? And I can see my wife also, like, explaining things to her, like, about she's a lot more patient than me, right? And I think she's more along the lines of your philosophy than mine. So I can see her doing those things, and I can see her starting to put those thoughts together. But I wonder if we had started earlier, if like that potential of capacity, the potential and capacity to understand these things would have been bigger if we had just started earlier and just treated as if it was normal to make those decisions and process information, right?
In parenting and in business, now is the second best time to start.
Right, that was very well said. Very well said. I love that. I mean, I do want to hop back a little bit, but I got to go now. I'm going to hopscotch and then go back to the very first part of the questionnaire here. But I want to know about your childhood. So now I kind of talked to you about you and your professional journey, and then I kind of talked about Spencer a little bit here. But now I'm curious where it all started. If we can kind of go back to the historical context here, how did you grow up?
Yeah. So I'm the only father of my parents, of my mother and father, but I had three half siblings. My mother had three kids from a previous marriage, and they were sort of teenagers and rebellious at the time that I was in diapers, and so by comparison, I was quite easy to handle for them. You know, I wasn't stealing a car. They regarded me as an angel. And I never felt like I needed to push against them, like in a rebellious way. I saw how destructive the rebellion was of my siblings, and it took a long time for them to repair their relationships afterwards in their adult life. My mom was one of the first executive coaches. I got the business through nepotism. She was very early to the career, but she was a high school dropout. So she was pregnant with my sister and going to a Catholic high school, and they didn't permit her to finish because it was embarrassing that she was showing.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and welcome to the 60s, right?
Well, you're talking about like how just this short amount of time ago, these things were sacrilegious or taboo. And so you're literally like talking about it from experience, like viscerally. Yeah, that's amazing. Okay.
And my dad was a Harvard MBA. So she had no high school diploma. And he was at Harvard MBA. And they represented these sort of extremes on the continuum between live for the moment, carpe diem, improvise, make it up as you go along, and plan, study, work. And I leaned, especially younger, more towards my mom's persona. I was not a good student. I was very casual about keeping any kind of promises I may have made as a child or, as a kid. chores were always a chore, you know. You would never ask me to do something once and then it would be done. That wouldn't have been my MO. But more than anything else, I absolutely knew that I was loved. I just knew that I was cherished. And then my sort of professional aptitude really came later, came about midway through college. I realized it was up to me to make the kind of impact I wanted to have, and that to do that, I was going to have to try to be my best at something. And that life isn't about what you can get away with, but it's about what you can contribute. Mm. So I was like mid-20s by the time I had that shift of mindset. And that's when things really kicked into high gear professionally for me.
It's awesome. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it. And then if I can ask, like, now that you're, literally older and wiser, quite literally, right?
Very literally older, yeah.
Yeah. Well, What are you now measuring success as based on that kind of epiphany you had in the mid-20s? Like, what's business success for you now?
Well, business has been amazing. I'm certainly in the top 1% of the top 1% of all coaches in terms of earnings, and I have more incoming requests than I can say yes to.
Unbelievable! Congratulations, that's really great.
And I do no marketing or sales. I only answer emails when people say they'd like to work with me, and coach all day. I show up to calls like this and I just respond to people. To me, there's a particular feeling when someone lets go of an idea that they should be something and comes into an appreciation for that which they are, where who I am is glorious, and they realize that, like, who I am is glorious. And that moment where they previously weren't thinking that, and now that's the truth, that's my moment. That's my purpose, is to try to work with people and have conversations with people so that they have that moment. And so business success for me is how many people are having that.
Wow. That is not the answer I was expecting at all. That's fantastic. That's very cool. It almost sounds like you play kind of like a mission-driven role here with your executive coaching.
Well, if you think about the reason why most founders started the companies that they started.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a mix of, I wanted to make a difference, I wanted to solve a problem, but also I wanted to prove that I could do it because some part of me was afraid that I couldn't.
Yeah.
And that part gets in the way of completing the mission of the startup if you don't transcend it at some point. It's because you start to make bad decisions in service to trying to prove that you're the one that can do it. And that has to be removed from the equation at some point.
That's so interesting. I know exactly what you're talking about, actually. That hits me so deep in the heart. I actually look for that characteristic when I try to find people to work with, because I'm not an executive coach, but I'm on the operation side. I'm more of a doer, right? And I do consulting for doing. And I look for CEOs with that problem, mm-hmm. founders with that problem, because I find that those people, I call it chip on your shoulder. They have something to prove, and they will literally, like, quite literally, like, walk the line to pushing themselves beyond the point of no return, past like physical harm, mental harm, to like achieve a goal, because they have something that's like haunting them, essentially, like making them move forward. And I just love that, because I know that those are the people that I can really like thrive and work with, and you know, and I can help win, right? Because what they really sometimes need is just someone they can just like go get shit done with them, you know. And so, and I love that. I love to do things. I love to build things. I love to build systems and processes. And so when someone is like, hey, I don't care what it takes, we're going to do this, I'm like, awesome, we're going to see this system and process all the way through. Brilliant. You know what I mean? Like, it's so funny, because you're literally talking about something that I also look for. And you're saying that most all founders have.
Oh, no, it's definitely there and it's in some degree. The problem, and I don't know if you've seen enough of these founders scale to 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 times their size. But when that happens, if the business grows bigger than the chip on their shoulder, they can't lead it anymore unless they have a different way of operating.
Oh, wow.
Because the size of the chip on their shoulder has them motivated to a degree. But then once they started to succeed enough that it's sort of proven, whatever they wanted to prove is proven, then that particular motivation is run dry. And they need a, they need an alternate motivation to keep going. Otherwise, the company implodes.
Oh, wow. Wait. Do you have any part in adding a new chip on these people? Okay. I'm like, this sounds crazy to me. I'm like, wait, my mind is just blown here. So I can see what you're talking about, though, because eventually you're going to reach that success level that the delta doesn't make sense anymore, right? Where you feel like you've proven it in all the aspects that you qualify success, right? A certain level. And then are you saying then you help them, like, navigate that process or transition out? Or
It's like changing the fuel from a motorboat to a sailboat.
Got it.
So motorboat fuel is very useful. You can go in any direction you want. You just lay on the gas.
Yeah.
Although the faster you go, the less fuel you have.
Yeah.
The more successful you are, the less afraid you'll not be successful.
Yeah. Right?
And so the fuel literally drains. Sailboat works differently, which is in concert with the environment. You can't just go any which direction. You can't sail into the wind. If there's no wind, you're not going anywhere. But the Oracle 12-meter yacht is one of the fastest sailboats in the world. It can go almost 40 miles an hour in 40 mile an hour downwind. So it goes as fast as a motorboat.
Wow.
Although if you're on the deck, if you're going 40 miles an hour in 40 mile an hour wind the same direction, the wind on your face is nothing.
Non-existent, yeah.
And it has hydrofoil, so it lifts up out of the water, and it's gliding on top of the waves, no splashing. So the experience on deck is stillness, even though in real terms, you're going 40 miles an hour over ground. And that different way of leading, that different way of designing your life and designing your company and working with your team, is when you're motivated by surplus, by love, or by service. So surplus is, I've got an extra thing and you don't have any of it and I want you to have it. You know, when Richard Branson starts a new company, he's chairman or owns over 300 companies. When he starts a new company, he doesn't start a company because he's saying, God, maybe my dad will finally be proud of me if I start this 317th company. You know, it's not his motivation for doing it. Like Rupert Murdoch, who in his autobiography said when he made his first billion, he shook his fist at the sky in the backyard of his mansion. He shook his fist and he said, "Are you happy now?" Ostensibly talking to his deceased father.
Yeah.
But Richard Branson, he starts a company when he meets someone who he believes is an incredibly gifted leader. And Richard has a surplus of something, a company, an idea, resources, financing, capital, connections.
Network, yeah.
Network, exactly. He has a surplus of that that he can give to this person to see them become themselves as the leader of that new company. And that's what motivates Richard to start something new. That's sailboat. It's not no chip on Richard's shoulder.
Wow. Then so you're just, the fuel is different. You just, it's not replacing. It's literally shifting.
Exactly.
Oh man, that's awesome.
That's what I help people shift. What fuel they use in their, in their startups and their careers, so that the companies that they care about won't be limited by the amount of fear they experience.
Oh wow! So you said you alluded to the fact that you got into this pretty early on, and you got into it because your mom was doing it. And 27 does sound really young.
It does, yeah. If I met a 27-year-old who was going to coach me, I would have some words for sure.
So then how does that, did you start at 27 or did you get into stride at 20? You started at 27 and that was day one at 27 years old. And did you get your, like you said, through osmosis and some from your mom's help and things like that. But like, was that like a training or like, what did that look like?
I mean, so she handed me a client. So I my first business was in Hollywood. I was doing post-production sound and picture editing and stuff for movies and TV. And that's what I did in college. Mm-hmm. And then I started a little business doing it. And I sold the business in 2000. And then I was trying to decide what I wanted to do next, and my mom said, why don't you coach with me? And I said, Mom, I don't want to fly home and live with mommy and sing Kumbaya for a living. You know, no way. Well, just try it. Just try it. I've got one client. You should talk to her.
Yeah.
And so she basically handed me a client, just introduced me to one. And then she invited me to participate in her coaching session. So I physically sat in the room while she coached these executives. And for many months, I just wrote down every word she said. And I was from the film business, so I wrote down the time code that she said it to. I was like, here's what she said, and this is the time. Here's your... And then I started to see patterns. I'm like, oh, okay, I see this pattern. This pattern. So after a few months of shadowing, really a phenomenal coach, one of the innovators in the industry, happened to be my mom, so grateful. I found that I could do it.
Wow, that's an amazing story. And then obviously you've honed that craft pretty well, because you're obviously incredibly successful, and that has led you to coaching some of the most prolific entrepreneurs that we know of today, right? Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, I have a million questions about that too, but I'll definitely just save that for the podcast when I start a business podcast. But I feel satiated right now with the amount of information that I have. Yeah, it's very great. Let me switch gears to just be mindful of your time. And I just like to ask the same questions, to every guest. So there's some sort of like similarity to each episode. So I'm going to jump into those rapid fire ones, okay?
Okay.
What advice do you have for other parents and soon-to-be parents?
That parenting is not the relationship with the child. The relationship with the child is your reward for parenting. The parenting happens by modeling who you are when you're at your best in front of them. So do your best to expose your most difficult dilemmas to the children as early as possible. Do your best to expose them to when you fight, to when you restore, to when you cry, to when you have no idea what to do, because that is what is going to actually teach them what they need to know.
That's amazing. I would never have ever thought to do that. That is amazing. Very, very cool feedback and advice. That's incredible. It was advice, but I took it as feedback because I felt like you were just talking right into my heart there. Oh, man.
Well, I have a lot of fondness for you, so if you feel it in your heart, that doesn't surprise me.
That's awesome. Let me go to the next one. If you can go back and tell yourself one thing before having kids, what would you tell yourself?
It's a good question. So, I would tell myself that everything that I thought I was hiding, it is very plain for everyone else to see. So everything I thought I was able to hide is not hidden, and act as though everyone can read it like a billboard. That's what I tell myself. Because I spent the first many years trying to appear like I had things together when I didn't have them together.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's a good piece of advice to yourself, but also to a lot of people. I mean, I think that's the reality, right? Like, parenthood is like, doing this podcast has been so eye-opening for me on that really, like, nobody really knows what they're doing. And, you know, we're all trying to figure it out. And so that's really sage advice, yeah.
Well, if you ask 100 parents, and you probably have, is it a good idea? Do you want your kids to lie to you? They would all say
no. No, yeah,
now
exactly.
Ask the same ones, okay, are you willing to say everything to your kids?
Oh gosh, yeah, most of them would say no. Yeah, that's right.
So how are you going to model authenticity and honesty if you're not willing to tell the truth to your kids?
Yeah, it's a very good point. Very good, Brian. What is the most surprising thing that you learned about yourself after becoming a parent?
Just how resourceful I am, that preferences and sleep and diapers and inconvenience, it's just not a big deal.
Yeah.
It's just nothing. And every aspect of parenting is there to be enjoyed.
That's awesome.
That was a surprise. I thought it was going to be a mix of these sacrifices and rewards, and it just hasn't been that.
Yeah.
It's just been awesome.
Yeah, that's wild. Yeah. Yeah, I have to agree with that. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you do have to like kind of remind yourself to remember that it's all awesome, but it is very fun all the time. Yeah,
you know, like if you're in a really strenuous workout, it's not like there aren't sensations going on. And sometimes there can be, but
yeah,
it's not like suffering. Otherwise, why are you doing it? Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't have to. It doesn't have to be.
You're right. I definitely want you to repeat your book because I want the listeners to go buy a copy and have reference to it. But if it's different than your book, the question is what's your favorite? What's your all-time favorite business book?
Well, so I will say the name of my book, The Last Safe Investment, which is more of a personal life planning finance book. Basically, don't invest in things outside your mm-hmm. control. If you invest in yourself instead of the stock market, your returns are going to be much, much greater. And it tells you how to do that.
Mm.
But I think my all-time favorite business book is Good to Great, Jim Collins.
Oh, wow. Yeah, Collins, yeah.
And one of the things I love about it so much is that he did the research before he made the conclusions.
Oh, got it.
And almost every other business book, some guy had a smart, or gal, had a smart idea, and then they went to do research to validate it. And Jim and his whole team, it's a whole collaboration of people. They did it the opposite way, where they just interviewed the good companies and the great companies and looked for what the contrasts were. And what came out of those interviews is the content of the book. And it's surprising and it's powerful.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I love that book as well, but I never thought about it in that light,
yeah.
The authenticity of the content because of that. That's a really good point. Now you're making me want to go read that book. I'm also going to read your book as well, too, but yes. Okay, last question to bring us home here.
Oh, by the way, my book is the exact opposite. It was just me thinking a lot of smart ideas, then looking for the research to validate exactly what I did. I think you'll still like it, but that's one of the, it does not have the scientific rigor that Jim does.
I appreciate the transparency, and I appreciate you calling that out. Yes, thank you. So last question to bring us home. When you're not being an awesome, dad that's philosophical and evolving, or a super coach, helping the next generation of startups and entrepreneurs succeed, what do you do for fun? What's your downtime stuff?
So many things. So I'm a very serious electronic music producer and DJ.
No freaking way.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
I'm putting together a party at Burning Man, which will have 4,000 or 5,000 people at it. I'll be headlining. It's an epic EDM all night extravaganza at Burning Man. My wife runs the Burning Man camp, Camp Mystic. I'm also a improvisational pianist. I play every day and I'm working on a piano album for this year. I'm a dedicated sailor.
Whoa. So
I've spent 60 or 70 weeks out on the open water on sailboats as a captain. We'll often go as like a vacation where we'll rent a boat. It's called a bear boat because there's no crew. It's just you and the boat, and we'll go and cruise around in whether it's Tonga or, the British Virgin Islands or whatever. And, so those are just a few things that really capture my attention.
Oh my gosh, that's so unexpected. That's amazing. Holy cow. Are you just picking up hobbies like this? Are you just an avid learner? Are you like voracious for new knowledge? Like where's this stuff coming
from?
Well,
music's always been a big part of my soul and a big part of who I am. I'm an artist. And so that's that. But I think you should do everything that excites you. And if there's something that you're attracted to as an idea or I always wanted to play drums. So, my wife bought me a drum set and then I started playing drums every day. You know what I mean? Like you just, if you want it, you do it. And yeah. I think there's a lesson or a nugget or an experience available through that pursuit that's crucial to the makeup of who you are, that you only get to have if you allow yourself to express it. I think your desires are sacred, and you should follow them.
Amazing way to end the podcast. That was incredible, Brian. Thank you so much for your time, your wisdom, your knowledge, all of your stories and your insights. I had a wonderful time. Thank you so much for this.
I had a great time too. And thank you for assembling the dads and the parents who care about doing this well. It just touches my heart to be, you know, with an audience of people who care about their children, who want to be the best parents they can be, and who also want to express themselves in business. And so thank you for doing what you're doing and for doing the work of assembling the audience.
I appreciate you saying that. That actually means a lot to me.
You got
thank
it.
You very much, Brian. We'll talk soon, okay?
Thank you for listening to The Girl Dad Show. Please take a moment to follow us on social media. You can find us at The Girl Dad Show on all major platforms. We look forward to staying in touch and keeping you up to date with all the new guests that are coming out.